that sounded good. Sorry, Dick, I'm not going to straighten it out, but back to you, WS2N.
You straightened me out. I could think of protons. I could barely think of neutrons. I wasn't able to think of neutrinos. Just that word escaped my brain completely. Had a drop out there of the signal-to-noise ratio mentally. Couldn't think of neutrinos. That's what I think Barry's really referring to. Protons and neutrons are easy to stop. A piece of paper will stop them. But neutrinos, I've heard it once said that neutrinos coming out of the sun, if you made them penetrate 55 million miles of solid steel, there would be a 50% probability of one impact. So whatever a neutrino is, it does have an extremely tiny amount of mass. It appears to have no charge. It must be an extremely small particle because it can go through 55 million miles of steel and only have one chance in two of running into one of those molecules of steel. At one time, you would take a particle accelerator like the alternating gradient synchrotron out at Brookhaven Laboratory, or the CERN, or the one in Illinois, I can't think of the name of it right now. Anyhow, Fermilab, you take any of their particle accelerators, or the LINEAC accelerator you've got at Stanford University, take the beam coming out of there, aim it through, let's say, half a mile of dirt by just aiming it into the ground. What comes out the other side that easily penetrates all of that and doesn't even get slowed down, whatever that is, you call it neutrinos. And so to build a neutrino detector, this guy from Brookhaven Lab went down to a mine, I think it was in North Dakota, that was 3 miles below grade, and he sets up this huge tank of perchlorate, cleaning fluid, because when a neutrino hits cleaning fluid, it gets converted in a way that he could easily measure. So he was measuring the solar flux of neutrinos, and he kept coming up with one-third the predicted number. That had everybody really going for a long period of time. And now there's been alternate confirming experiments to say, yes, the sun only puts out one-third the number of neutrinos we expected. And for a while, that had people really worried because they thought that, okay, if the middle of the reaction in the middle of the sun is putting out one-third of the number of neutrinos, does that mean the sun is slowing down in its power output? And because it takes a few hundred thousand years for the energy of the center of the sun to slowly percolate up to the surface of the sun. It's a very slow process for that energy to slowly percolate up there. And so therefore, we're looking 100,000 years ahead of time, and we're going to go into an ice age. And there were people worried about that. And now the latest theory, as I remember, is that there's at least three different kinds of neutrinos, and they flip back and forth between the kinds as they propagate, and there's only one kind that we're sensitive to. So I think it's neutrinos you were thinking about, Barry. And boy, they're real difficult particles to explain, because how do they go through everything with almost never any reaction? N2, Moonbound, KQRIW.
I'm sitting here cooking fish at the same time. That's why the dog is getting so excited. We're making salmon, folks. Okay, yes, it was neutrinos that I was thinking about, and... has anybody been able to measure the speed of the neutrinos? And you tell me that you think they are restricted by the same, whatever that restriction is, that slows light down. And I don't think it's a restriction. I think it's a transition that's slowing. In other words, the transition just cannot take place faster. That's limiting its speed. But that's only a guess. And I'll let you guys take it in 2MB.
Okay. And by the way, the latest article you can read or see on television on the subject of good health. Apparently, sockeye red salmon is considered extremely healthy material. It's got just the right kinds of fish oil. It's got the right kind of vitamin D. Real healthy stuff to eat. So such a good meal. Anyhow, we'll throw it back to you again, Barry, so you just can keep right on cooking. To my knowledge, nobody has an easy way of modulating neutrinos. I guess you could, I see no reason. Since they're able to make neutrinos in a particle accelerator, and since that beam in the particle accelerator can be turned on and turned off, And since those particles are running around in a circle of a usual particle accelerator at very close to the speed of light, 0.99 the speed of light, and that's how you keep turning on the individual boosters along the length of the ring to try to add energy to the particle bundle you've got going down the tube, so to speak, you do have a way of modulating it, and therefore it would be a very simple experiment as long as you can detect neutrinos. They're hard to detect, but as long as you can detect them, you could measure their velocity. I'm almost positive you'd come up again with the speed of light. Essentially, everything that propagates through a vacuum propagates at the speed of light. Since the neutrinos going through 55 million miles of steel only have one impact, would the neutrinos slow down when they go through the steel? What would be the apparent dielectric constant or velocity factor of neutrinos going through steel? That would be an interesting experiment. I know that when you put a light wave through anything that's more dense than vacuum, in general the wave always slows down by what we call index of refraction. When you measure index of refraction, you could say you're measuring how easy it is to make that material into a magnifying glass, into a lens. That's what you could say you're doing. But you're really measuring the velocity of propagation when you measure index of refraction. So what's the index of refraction of neutrinos going through steel? That'd be a great experiment. Not easy. Do they slow down when they go through steel? Because they have so few impacts, I ain't sure. However, they are going through the medium, and everything up until now going through a medium slows down by the velocity of propagation through that medium. As you can tell, we're getting pretty far afield here. Maybe we ought to come back to Earth. Let's see, I think it was N2EO who said he didn't have a question. I bet you after listening to Barry and Mel and Dick, he's going to have a couple of questions. N2EO, hey, Rich, what do the guys in Whitestone, Queens think about all this jazz? K2RIW and the TechNet. Okay, maybe Rich is not near his transmitter right now. Hey, Bob, have I got you correct? W2OQD, maybe your subject... Notice that the audio gets decreased when the announcement's being made. Maybe your question's coming a little bit more down to earth. You got it, Bob.
KB1, no kidding. Well, Dick and everybody in the net have been off there for a while. I guess warmer weather's up there, and being outside and a little more has kept me away from the tech net on Sundays, though. But anyway, question, Dick, on coax cable. I'm running RG58X cable for my antenna there, for my J-pole and my log periodic antenna. And I have some of it coiled up in the house there because I didn't use the full length that I had, and I didn't want to cut it just in case I have to move the shack around downstairs there. But I think Mel one time said to me, he says, it doesn't matter how many connectors you put on, there's not really too much loss. Is there any effect on coiling the coax that would affect the, you know, receiving and transmitting?
I think the answer is no. Other than the length creating insertion loss, and your particular coax, if for instance it was RG8U and you're using it at 432 megacycles, 450 megacycles, it's got around, if it's in good shape, it's got around 4.5 dB per 100 feet of loss. So when you use extra length, you get a little bit of extra loss. Other than that, when the signal is going through the coax, it is only looking at what's going on between the center conductor and the shield, and whether or not the whole darn piece of coax is coiled into a coil, running out straight, or set up on the lawn in such a way that it's writing out your initials, that signal going down the center of the coax doesn't know that. Up until the point where you make the bend radius so sharp that you start doing something nasty like almost short-circuiting the center conductor to the outer shield. Other than exceeding the manufacturer's recommended bend radius, a signal going down the center of the coax doesn't know what you've done on the outside. You could have the coax itself, it's of a high enough in quality, particularly if it's a hard line. It could be going under a mile of seawater. It could be going through a bath of oil, hot oil, or whatever. All of that doesn't matter. The signal only sees what's going on inside the cable. Maybe that helps a little bit. You got it, Bob.
Yeah, it does, Dick. It does very much. Because, like I said, I want to avoid cutting it if I have to. You know, like I said, maybe I was looking towards the future here, just in case I did have to move the shack around down here in the basement there to another part of the area without turning around splicing lines there. The cable's already existing there. I don't have to. And I'm just going to, right now, I'm just talking off the J-pole with you, and I'm going to be running another, I think maybe 50 feet of another length of cable to go to the live periodic antenna so I can switch back and forth. But I think that's it as far as that. Oh, the space shuttle is up now, and I've been catching them on, I forget what frequency was, 145.35 something there, in conversation. Are we allowed to turn around and conversate with them at any time? Is there an open time when to talk to the shuttle?
Essentially, no. First of all, if you owned a TVRO, television receive only terminal, that means the old-fashioned type satellite receiving dish that used to be a 10-foot diameter dish. If you owned one of those and you listened to a program rebroadcast by a geosynchronous satellite, which is called NASA Select, it used to be called the NASA Contract Channel, and you listened there, the original intent of the channel was that the 14 different divisions of National Aeronautics and Space Administration needed a common medium by which they could all talk to each other, so to speak, and they set up this synchronous satellite communication network. When a space shuttle launch has taken place, or when some other spacecraft is being launched from Cape Canaveral or Vandenberg Air Force Base or Kourou, South America, that video and audio is put over that channel. So if you own one of these TVROs, and I do, and you tune to the right frequency, you listen to astronaut audio live. When I say live, I mean it's a third of a second old, because it's being sent from the shuttle on a KU band frequency up to the satellite, from the satellite back down to White Plains. It's going through a TDRS NASA-owned satellite. TDRS stands for Tracking Data Relay Satellite. So they own these three satellites that are strategically positioned around the Earth so that you've got continuous coverage of your spacecraft. And so from the spacecraft, the space shuttle, the signal is sent on KU band up 22,300 miles to that satellite. It goes back down to White Sands, where they've got a receiving site, back up on the ordinary commercial satellite, and then back down to all the NASA centers. And you're allowed to listen to that center. In the beginning, it was intended just for internal communication for NASA. Pretty soon they realized that, hey, NASA is not military, it's civilian, it's owned by us, the taxpayers, and pretty soon they started using it in such a way that they invited the media, in other words, your major networks, to listen to that, copy any of the material they want, reproduce it on the news programs, and so on. Okay, there is a individual in Huntington who has a satellite receiving system. He picks up that astronaut audio. He sends it over on one of the Huntington repeaters, 145.43 megacycles, he's repeating NASA Select channel. So you're not hearing the astronauts direct, you're hearing the astronauts through that whole network that I just described to you. Can you now talk back to them on 145.43 megacycles? No way in hell. No. When it comes to the uplink to the satellite, to the space shuttle, that's a very private communication channel, and only the Capcom in Houston, Texas, is allowed to talk on that uplink. Essentially, nobody else, with a slight exception. Every so often, you get an astronaut like Owen Garriott, as he did on Space Shuttle number 64, I think it was, 65, way back in 1985 or so. He brings his handy talkie into space. He does what's called the ARIS experiment, amateur radio in space, and he hooks up a temporary antenna by taping it to the window of the space shuttle, and he talks back down to the amateur radio operators during his free time, during his off time, when he's not on duty, so to speak. Then, yes, there's a quasi two-way communication that does take place, and I'm one of the people on Long Island, one of the free people, that supposedly talked to astronaut Owen Garriott. When I say supposedly, what it really means is that when he played back the tape recording of zillions of people talking to him all at once, screaming their call letters, and he plays back the tape recording, he hears my tape recording in the noise, and I got an official notice from him saying that, yes, I heard you, and we had a QSO. Well, did I really have a man-to-man contact like the Shah of Iran did when he flew over that territory where there were very few ham operators? Of course I did not. But I did get official notice of having a contact with the space shuttle. I wouldn't call that a a very friendly two-way too, so because of how many people were trying to do it simultaneously. So, as you can see, that except for the periods of time when a astronaut ham radio operator has free time and was given permission to bring the equipment on board, except for that, and I guess there is equipment on the shuttle and on the International Space Station. I think there is equipment, and I believe there are designated periods of time in which you're allowed to have contact with them. I think there is a digipeater there, and I believe you can get your digital signal repeated by the International Space Station. And I think there are people who are very proud of having done that. So under normal circumstances, though, just because you're hearing the astronauts before they've linked up, they're on the shuttle, and they're not doing one of these designated ham radio experiments, I think, in general, you can't talk to them. Maybe that's part of the answer to what you're looking for, Bob. KB1OQD, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, KB1OQD.
All right, Dick.
That about sums it up. And appreciate it. Thanks again there, as usual. Like the Shell answer man there. Anyway, well, thank you again. And probably talk to you again next week. In the meantime, 73 to you and everyone in the net here. And thanks again there. So we'll be flight to the side. KB1OQD. We'll be clear.
Okay, Bob. Thank you for the compliment. Be careful, though. What you're hearing is a lot of opinions. You get what you pay for. You didn't pay very much to get these opinions, and there's no guarantee on their accuracy. When in doubt, go check them, because let's face it, nobody bats a thousand. Mel, Paul, Dick, and everybody else, and Rick, who and Barry, who signed into the TechNet, we're giving out our opinions on all these subjects. Not all of our opinions are traceable to the Bureau of Standards, if you know what I mean. So go check it out yourself before you invest money in any of the things that we're talking about. Okay, let's see. Steve said he didn't have a question. I think Rich said he didn't have a question. N2EO. Let me give a quick listen to make sure we haven't skipped over somebody. If not, we'll go over to Paul. He's going to tell us what's going on in space. So, is there anybody I've skipped? K2LAW in the TechNet, listening.
W2PNJ, just listening.
Okay, Mr. PNJ. And, okay, he's monitoring. Paul, WS2N. What's the latest? When are they going to link up? I think they've brought up some new solar cells. That means they're going to get more power to you, you can say to the astronaut. And so, what's the latest there, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. And before I started with that, I just wanted to comment. Did you see this month, June, QST, one of your favorite topics, the 75-ohm hardline being tied and coupled in with the SO239?
Yes, I did catch that. I think it was under technical topics, or was it under Hints and Kings, or one of these columns. And without a doubt, 75-ohm hardline is an extremely high-quality, inexpensive cable. If you live anywhere within driving distance of a stockyard where they stock the parts that they use for cable television. And now's the time to get your hands on that stuff, because I suspect fiber optic is going to become more and more prevalent, and cable television, I think, is going to decrease a little bit in emphasis in the future. That's an opinion. I'm not sure, but that's what I think. Because fiber has the ability to give you many gigahertz of bandwidth. Cable, coaxial cable, even though it's a very high-quality cable, really is limited in bandwidth by modern standards. And those are very relative words. When television first came around, a 6-megacycle-wide television signal was considered very broadband. A modern-day cable television system is 800 megacycles wide. And here I am calling 800 megacycles of width not very wide anymore compared to fiber, which is many thousands of megacycles wide. So a lot more information can bidirectionally go through fiber with a lot less insertion loss. Therefore, I have reason to believe that fiber is going to become more dominant in our future. And so you'd be amazed how many communities right now are getting fiber cable installations in parallel with the coaxial cable that's already there. And so the residents, for the time being, can choose between the two, or if they're rich enough, buy both systems and have the best of both worlds. But it's my belief that fiber is going to become more dominant. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. And as you were speaking, I looked it up again. Page 53. June. Pretty good. I think it's a little different. It's a little different system. It uses glue and sheet metal screws, whatever, but aluminum tubing. So it's pretty good. The space shuttle, surprisingly, got off on time. It's usually a weather delay or something. There was a possible delay that they were thinking about. They checked out Endeavour. That's the next one. That's going to go up. And it had a misalignment between the flanges of the 17-inch diameter fuel and oxygen line, the two lines that go from the external tank that actually bolts up to the space shuttle itself, and they were wondering maybe we have a problem with this. So they looked into that, and I guess they ironed that out because there was no problem. It was delayed initially, of course, because this thing was supposed to go up middle of March, March 15th, and due to the hailstorm, once in a 40-year time that they've had this problem, completely socked the external tank, which is really like a big thermos bottle with just nothing but insulation. Got all pitted and destroyed, and they had to sand down certain areas. Other areas that were dug in more, they had to fill in. I like to use the expression "great stuff." That's similar to what it is. They spray it on, and then they harden, and they sand it, and they picked up some 4,000 little spots they had to look at the on the orbiter. Mm-hmm. And it did get on, off on time, successfully bring seven astronauts into space. One will stay on permanently, Clay Anderson. He will stay on the next, until October. Anita Williams will be they'll bring her back on the space shuttle. STS-117 will be bringing her back. And she's now got a record up there for longest woman. Shannon Lucid was the longest American woman up there. She got her time beat. More space walks for any other woman. I think she's up to four. And this was a rookie flight, when she got sent up there half a year ago. She stayed up. She was supposed to come back earlier, but due to the delay of this launch, things happened. So that's the story there. They are bringing up a gigantic another segment there, these trust segments. They call it 3 and 4. Extending this essentially almost 200 foot long truss arrangement. Keeps getting longer every time. Every once in a while, another shuttle will bring this another truss section up, and including on this truss is going to be another one of these solar panels. There's two up there now, two gigantic solar panels, and this will be a third one that they're going to unfurl and become part of the station. So they call it there's two up there now. One is folded up, and one is extended. One that's folded up was extended for years since the one up there back in 2001, and they've got that all folded up. The one that's stretched out now in a permanent position has been operating the station. This is a third one that they're bringing up. They'll put it on the opposite side. It'll look more balanced out when they do that. Then another one will be going up, probably at the end of this year or next year. That will be put on the port side. So then you'll have three permanently mounted ones. So one that originally went up there, that's all folded up, will eventually be disconnected and moved with the robotic arms all the way to the end of the starboard section, no correction, the port section. You can call it P6. Yeah, that would be the port section. So you'll have three up there. You'll have one for the port and two for the starboard. And this little, that when they finally do that last one, that's all folded up now, that was in a temporary location, it will be put into its final location, and the solar array segment of the station will be complete. So, three spacewalks to do all of this. It's going to be quite involved. There is a little question about a blanket that's been torn back down by the Holmes rocket, the orbital maneuver system rocket, the two rockets that they could bring on and bring off a number of times. When they make orbit, they fire them, and when they break orbit, they'll fire these two rockets right up near that area, really like the top side of the space shuttle as you look at it. It kind of folded back. Years ago, the early flights, they used to put white tiles in those areas, and they used dozens of them, you know, so they've given up with that, and they shoot thermal blankets, top part of the orbit, and that's what gets it. As hot, it doesn't get these 3,000 degree temperatures like you'll get on the leading edge of the wings. So I don't think they're concerned about it, but the news is starting to make a little bit of a thing of it. So they've inspected the orbiter with the robotic arm. From early reports I heard, that all looks good. That's now standard procedure, you know, when they first go up, before they get to the space station, and when they leave the space station. They also do a 360 pirouette at the station. The station photographs the shuttle and takes care of that inspection deck. So there you go. A little long-winded, but what do you do? K2RIWWS2N.
Next tonight at 8 o'clock.
Very fine, Paul. Thank you for all the info. Are you getting your information from NASA Select? In other words, are you one of those lucky guys where your cable TV system gives you a channel that is showing you what's going on with NASA? Or are you doing it what I call the hard way by going to individual websites that are giving you that information and either watching brief movies or actually reading it all? How are you getting all of your space information that keeps you so well informed, Paul? Go ahead.
Variety of places, of course the internet, the newspapers, whatever little clip you can possibly pull out of CNN, that's always good. MSNBC, they have a reporter there that's pretty good. You team that together with all the different magazines, and, but the current events part, NASA Select, don't have. Current events come mostly from www.nasa.gov. So, I like that one. When you get tired of reading about the space shuttle, you can click on, oh, something else, like the messenger program, or the one that's on the way to Mercury and going to be orbiting the planet in 2011. And they go from one space mission to the next. I recommend www.nasa.gov, and you can go on your merry way and whittle away your hours, Dick, doing that. Back to you.
Fantastic. Boy, would you be happy if you had NASA Select. There are people who are not highly space-oriented will just say, gee, it's a little bit boring. Nothing else happens. Hours on end, you'll just see a picture of the capsule communicator at Building 30 at Houston, Texas, sitting there occasionally communicating with the astronauts saying, please move switch number 47 on panel number 14 and turn on the oxygen source heater or something like that. And look out when you do that. That's what happened on Apollo 13, but you know what I mean. However, with NASA Select, when they're really doing something critical to the mission, like when you watch Story Musgrave, as I did, taking out every bolt one at a time, every nut and screw, and replacing a power supply or a gyro stabilizer or whatever, or climbing to the top of the Hubble Space Telescope, and that's where one of the gyro stabilizers was located. So we really had a catbird seat. I guess he was something like 80 feet or 60 feet above the floor of the space shuttle cargo hold, way up there at the limit of the extension of the Canadian arm, with his feet tied down to it. He's up there doing this repair. And as I remember, on that particular mission, on one of the repair missions, the shuttle was flying at nighttime over the middle of the United States. So he could see by the lights from the various cities, he was looking at essentially the whole United States simultaneously. My goodness, was that the catbird seat? And you could, with NASA Select, you could see what he is seeing because there's a camera on the end of the Canadian arm where he was. And so exciting stuff. Or you'll also see quite often when they're in a sleep period, they'll aim the camera from the Canadian arm just down at Earth. You watch Earth pass by at 17,500 miles an hour, but you're 140 nautical miles up, so it moves kind of slowly. And you see deserts and oceans and green areas and brown areas and so on. Some of the really exciting stuff is I remember on a couple of occasions I'd wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I'd see the screen of the television set flashing in a funny way. After a while, I finally figured out that they were flying over South America. A thunderstorm is going on over South America, and you're watching the individual lightning flashes on the northeast corner and the southwest corner of South America. When you look at a big country like that having a thunderstorm, I'm amazed at how correlated the lightning bursts are. In other words, the whole dark country is quiet for a couple of seconds, and then one corner of the country, you see a burst of lightning, and then almost simultaneously, all the other sections of the country have a lightning burst at the exact same period of time. And there's at least two different ways you can interpret that. Either the electromagnetic pulse that came out of the first lightning burst somehow triggered all the other lightning bursts that were just ready to go, or since there appears to be, in my mind, a heavy correlation between the way lightning zigzags and cosmic rays, that really create the ionized path, that create the individual portions of that zigzag, I've got a theory that periodically you get a burst of cosmic rays from space that hits the whole darn Earth simultaneously, and those cosmic rays hitting almost all of South America simultaneously are triggering the next band of lightning bursts. That's what I think is going on. So I think by way of those almost simultaneous lightning bursts, you're looking at the cosmic rays hitting in burst, a sheet of them coming in from space and hitting all of South America simultaneously. That's a theory of mine as to what I thought I was seeing. Another whole area of beautiful research as far as I'm concerned. And cosmic rays are interesting things because they've had a lot to do with the evolution of biological mechanisms on planet Earth. But that's another whole subject. Okay, Paul, keep up the good work, and glad somebody's keeping track of what's going on in space. When my NASA Select system was working, and I've got to do some repairs on my satellite system, the positioner is not working correctly, and I've got to fix that. So right now I can't steer it between the individual satellites, and I'm not getting NASA Select. And since I'm not busy now that I'm retired, and working as hard as I am on so many crazy projects, I haven't gotten around to repairing it. Okay, we're going to turn it over to Mel. And Mel, I'm sure you've got some pretty juicy emails this week with questions. Also, just to tune you into the saga, to bring you guys up to date, as we signed off last weekend, Mel and I and other people present slowly concluded what we think is nearly the impossible for people to believe, and that is that his very tiny tenth of a wavelength diameter loop antenna that's in the shack with him, and he uses it on either 80 or 40 meters or both, but the small loop antenna that's in the shack with him, when he properly positions it in azimuth, elevation, and tilt angle, gives him a considerably better signal-to-noise ratio than this huge antenna he's got in the backyard, which is four towers, 40 feet high, full 65-foot spacing between them, full wavelength loop antenna, 40 feet in the air, properly fed in various ways. He's getting more performance in the receive mode out of the simple loop antenna in the shack with him because it's so adaptable. And you tell that, we were making jokes about the fact that if Mel's is on the air and tells people this absolute truth that he is discovering, that he's been experimenting with now for going on a year, if he tells the guys on 80 and 40 meters what he's discovered, they're going to send the paddy wagon. They're going to send the guys in the white coat. They're going to definitely think he's crazy because the story is so unbelievable. But as you get down to reading the appropriate chapter of John Krause's book on antennas, I think Mel is right. I think he's right on. When he writes the article on what he's discovered, I predict he's going to have trouble publishing it because each of the editors of whatever magazine he sends it to are going to say, gee, this sounds like a nut paper. Very similar to what happened I did when I wrote the article on the parallel kilowatt amplifier, the strip line amplifier for 432. In those days, everyone was positive tubes had to be put in push-pull, not in parallel, and to make strip line a 3-pound amplifier produce a kilowatt of power on 432, people thought that was crazy. And when I sent that to Ham Radio Magazine, Skip Kenny and Jim Fisk, who was the editor, thought it was a nut paper and turned it down. And so, by the same token, when Mel writes this article on his tiny loop antenna, he's going to get some flack, and he's going to get some turn down, because people are not going to believe it. But I think he's got a very basic truth he's discovering. So, I can tell his hand is shaking a little bit when he starts writing that article, and when he puts the stamp on, he's going to send it away. He knows he's going to be in trouble, because it's a very tough story to sell, even though it's probably the truth. And so, that combined with some of the nice emails he gets keeps him off the streets at night. K2KUI, go right ahead, Mel. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger, this is K2KUI. Boy, did you ever hit the, as they say, the nail on the head. Boy, oh boy, did I get emails from last week's TechNet. Dick ranged everything from you guys don't know what the heck you're talking about to this sounds impossible. One guy said 1 minute you guys were telling us about your 100-foot towers and your thing and this and that, that you spend so much money in getting permits and fighting with the different local governments to put these antennas up, these towers up and all, and then the next minute you're telling us that you're sitting a thing in your shack and you feel it's going to perform to the same extent as what you have outside. I mean, you'd be amazed how many emails I got that you have drove us crazy with your last tech net stick. So I think that's what I was going to ask you, to say a few words about it. And if I ever do put this together in words on paper, I'll need your testimonial that I'm not, I just say, slightly off-center. Or maybe too much off-center. Big guy. Let's see, what else did I get? Oh, yes, I got some young person here, a couple of young people and all, that are starting to upgrade, and they got into a little bit of trouble with formulas, with math formulas. Also, we could take that up, and then, oh, yes, again, it's about the antenna, about remember the TAC antenna, the TAK. One guy said to me here that he says, years ago, there was an antenna that was wound up, they made a spiral winding on PVC pipe, it was on 40 meters, they were 2 6-foot lengths of PVC pipe that were supported in the middle and kind of rotated so you could do something with it. Is this basically the same principle as this TAC antenna? Another one said, yes, he had an antenna that he used in an apartment. What he did is he had a, he called it the floor lamp antenna, and it was basically used type of, with the, you know, standing floor lamp type configuration, the base and everything like that, and winds also, goes from floor to ceiling and winds a coil. Are these basically the same idea as this guy is using with the TAC antenna? Well, you want to make a comment on the stick, over.
Okay, when it comes to the spiral wound antenna on PVC pipe, I think there's a strong similarity there. There also was an antenna that was popular one time, maybe it still exists, called Isotron. And the floor lamp antenna. I'm not familiar with that one. However, all of these antennas are capable of giving you darn good performance, as long as you worry about the details. The highest detail, two or three main details that any compact antenna must do, is first, hopefully be made out of rather low resistance materials. You ain't going to make it out of carbon rods, if you know what I mean. So you're going to use good quality copper or whatever for the materials, and reasonable quality capacitors and inductors to do the choking, resonating, and so on. So most antennas have to be resonated, and even if the antenna is not radiated, the antenna plus feed line plus antenna tuner, that radiating system must be resonated in most cases if you want high performance. So once you get resonance of the antenna system, and once you make it out of the right materials, and once it gives you a reasonable standing wave ratio, in other words, near 50 ohms resistance as far as what the receiver sees, then you're going to get full performance. And so it's opposite of common sense. How can an antenna that has 1/10 the wavelength in dimensions, 1/100 the total amount of physical area, compared to the full-size antenna in the backyard, how can that antenna give you full performance? That's a very logical question. And it looks like you're really going beyond horse fence here when you claim that the tiny antenna can give the same performance. How is that possible? And a person asking that question, I would try to first direct him to the appropriate chapter of Krauss's book. The book is called Antennas. The very first edition was published by McGraw-Hill, one of the best technical publishing houses on planet Earth. McGraw-Hill published this book in 1950 called Antennas by Mr. John Krauss of Ohio University, who eventually became associated with the Electroscience Laboratory of Ohio University. Very respected research laboratory into radio research. So John Krauss, one of the big names, and happened to be a ham radio operator. I think he's now on Silent Key, W8JK, Whiskey Alpha, Whiskey 8, Juliet Kilo. All right. He writes this chapter in his book on antennas, which many colleges use the later editions of that book as a college textbook. In that book, in the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole, he literally tells you what happens. You take a full half-wave dipole on, say, 80 meters, 135 feet long, and you find out that your property isn't big enough. And so you start finding ways of physically compacting that antenna. You can put loading coils at the lower end, the middle, the top end. You can zigzag the wire in a planar manner, in a three-dimensional manner. You can put top hat capacitors on the end of the wire. There's all kinds of techniques by which you can make. We can leave the wire straight out flat and just make it short, but use a very strong antenna tuner, antenna matchbox, impedance matching device, near the antenna or through a fairly low loss piece of feed line. So by whatever means, you make the antenna physically smaller, but yet keep resonating it and keep making it have a good impedance match to your chunk of electronics. You keep doing that as you go from a full half-wave dipole to the infinitesimal dipole. As long as you can keep establishing resonance, as long as you can keep impedance matching, and as long as the resistance doesn't become dominant, you get within half a dB the exact same performance. And even the half a dB loss that you get is not loss in the I squared R manner. It is loss because the antenna pattern becomes a little bit more broad. Your 78 degrees of 3 dB beamwidth of a dipole goes up to 83 degrees or some number like that. And that's where the half a dB of change takes place. It's not loss of signal when you transmit with that infinitesimal dipole. As long as you don't arc it over, you put 100 watts into it, 99.9 watts is going to be radiated into space, even though the dipole is infinitesimal. That is a basic truth of antennas that every single antenna engineer, I bring that to their attention. They say, well, I haven't read that chapter. Or, yeah, I knew that chapter was there, but I didn't pay attention to it. It didn't make sense to me, or I didn't believe it. Those are the usual answers I get. I can go to people who I know who have been in the antenna designing profession for 10, 20, 25 years, and I bring that chapter to their attention, less than 10% of those thoroughly experienced people who have that narrow field of research as their main raison d'etre, I can bring that chapter to their attention, and the majority of them will not say, yea, verily, I believe it, I've used it. I use that chapter professionally now as a consultant. It is the truth. I can confirm it six ways from Sunday. I believe it, even though it sounds crazy. What's really going on is that any antenna you build, I don't care if it's full wave or infinitesimal, the majority of what takes place when you transmit a signal is that the signal does not just go from the feed line, jump onto the antenna, and then jump into space. The signal does not do that. Radiation, we take it for granted. We assume because a dollar's worth of wire hung up in the air as a dipole is going to give you an antenna, we assume that radiation is simple. It ain't. It's complicated. It's hard. At the molecular level, that signal has to bounce back and forth on that full half-wave dipole something like 30 times before it finally gets radiated into space. And a little bit of the signal is radiated on each one of those bounces. And what you and I call resonance is making sure that the antenna electronically has the right length so that all of those bounces stay in phase with each other. That's what radiation of an efficient transmitting antenna really is. The reason I say efficient transmitting antenna is I can make a cantenna, a Heathkit dummy load, and I put a small hole in the side of the can, and I put a window there, and a little bit of the signal leaks out. That's got extremely poor efficiency. But it is an antenna. It does radiate, and the guy next door is going to hear the signal. But it's not a good radiator. You're not going to get good signal reports on that. So when it comes to the class of antennas that have efficiency, where 99% of the energy is radiated to space and not turned into heat like it is inside of that cantenna, that dummy load. As long as I'm talking about that class of antennas, then radiation is hard. It has to all have this resonance phenomena. But once you meet that phenomena, all kinds of magic happens. The signal does get radiated. And once you accept the principle of superposition, however an antenna behaves when it's transmitting, and by haves, I mean, what is its standing wave ratio? What is its bandwidth? What is its beam width? What is its elevation angle? What is its efficiency? Anything you can measure about an antenna. Within reason, almost all the antennas you will ever see for the rest of your lifetime, whatever characteristics they have on transmission, they have the exact same characteristics on reception when you're using it as a receiving antenna. That is the theory of reciprocity. And all antennas that don't contain a ferrite circulator with a magnet in there, a gyrotropic material, as long as it's normal antennas without an amplifier built inside, normal antennas will obey reciprocity. So once you build an antenna such that you can put 100 watts into it and 99 watts gets transmitted into space somewhere, then by definition, that exact same antenna will work like gangbusters when you're receiving. And so where the hell is all that effective capture area coming from? A full half-wave dipole on 80 meters has 8,500 square feet of effective radio area. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you look broadside at that 80-meter full-wave dipole that might be in my backyard, your eyes would see a great big oval around that antenna with that much area to it, 8,500 square feet. So any signal that comes into the broadside of that antenna with the right polarization on the right frequency goes into that black area of that ellipse, ends up on that wire of that dipole, goes down that feed line, and pegs the S-meter on the receiver, the signal strength meter. That's what happens. And so when I take this 135-foot long dipole and squeeze it down to only a couple of feet, what would my eye see? Instead of 8,500 square foot oval, it would see something a little bit more circular with close to 8,000 square feet of area. And inside of that great big area is this little bitty infinitesimal dipole. How the hell can that little bitty dipole be capturing signal from that area? and the function, and what's really going on is that, as I said, when you're transmitting, that signal has to bounce back and forth on the full wave dipole 30 times. On the infinitesimal dipole, it probably has to bounce back and forth maybe closer to 1,000 times. And it's sucking up a little bit of the signal on each one of those bounces when you're receiving. And ultimately, it has close to the, within half a dB, it's got the same area. Boy, that's a hard concept to accept. But that's what Mel's doing. That tenth of a wavelength loop in his shack with him gives him the adaptability, because it's a darn small, he can steer it in polarization, he can steer it in azimuth, he can steer it in elevation. That really means he's aiming it, tilting it, and polarizing it, so he can maximize the signal-to-noise ratio of the way that signal gets through the ionosphere from his buddy in Pennsylvania, and the signal comes into his backyard in Manhattan Beach, Queens, or Brooklyn, sorry about that, and his signal has that capture area of around 8,000 square feet on 80 meters, even though it's this little hundredth of a square meter of 8,000 square feet, even though it's only a hundredth of a square meter of physical area. Of course, that sounds crazy. When he writes that article, it's going to be considered enough paper in the first couple of publishers he goes to until we give those publishers testimonials traceable to the Bureau, and I don't know how the hell we're going to prove it. He's going to have a hell of a time getting this particular truth across because it sounds so strange. Are you sure you want to fight this battle, Mel? K2KEY, what a crusader. K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I've told a few already on 75 meters. I have to rotate the antenna on to them. And of course, you can well imagine how their ears perked up and says, they come back and rotate. What? You have an antenna that you're rotating on 75 meters because you know what they're visioning right away. we're in Brooklyn, is this guy coming up with this? So put these things together, and of course, you listening on the other end can well imagine that. That's why I'm going to get those comments like I got on the email. That you're full of stuff. Whatever you're smoking, you better cut it out quick. by the way, got a number of very nice compliments, Dick, about the TechNet. I went to the HamFest out at the Flushing Meadows today, at Ozark, had their HamFest today, and it was a lot of things to see. Met a lot of people, especially I met store Andy there, said hello to Andy, who, you know, he was doing his thing there with testing out equipment and, you know, doing up clinic. And we sat around, stood around and had a nice talk with your friend Howie, WD2HWW, and let's see, who else we, we met a number of people, all send their regards to you, Dick. I was hoping maybe that you would show up there, but I guess you most likely had other things to do. But weather started in the morning. The weather was a little iffy, but started out, I could say, that, you know, mist and fog, but then it turned nice and sunny. So it was a fairly successful hamvention. Dick, go ahead.
Yeah, I got a couple quick questions. I hope you carry some kind of a sign. It says, hello, I'm K2KEY, Mel. And hopefully then by way of the TechNet, some of those people will say, hey, I've been hearing you. Is that what you look like? I mean, they listen to your voice, and of course they assume that you're a 6'3", blonde guy, blue eyes, Nordic looking, and they see somebody a little bit shorter than that, so they're probably a little bit surprised. But other than that, I hope you got some recognition. What else was I going to ask you? Yeah, Hosark. House of Science, Amateur Radio Club. No, it's not House of Science. Hall of Science. Here we go. Hall of Science, Amateur Radio Club. I guess they hold their first annual. There's going to be two of them this year, I think. One in the spring, one in the fall. Flea market. You might tell me, did you get some recognition? Did you see some hardware that you wish you could own? Did you bring any of yourself? Back to you, Mel.
D-A-Z. Somebody want to make a comment? Well, just give me 1 minute. Number one, I didn't buy anything. Yeah, I saw a lot of stuff, all kinds of things, you know. But I sort of tried to eliminate this business of bringing home every time I go to a ham fest more stuff, because it got out of hand here. I cleaned up, and I'm trying my best to keep my promise that this is it. Getting older now, Dick, and I, you know, things, you know, you think about it as we get a little older, that's not the same situation as, you know, I do collecting and doing all kinds of things years ago. And, yeah, well, I wear my shirt. I have this black shirt that I wear. It's not short sleeve. It's a regular T-shirt. It's black, and it has white letters right across on the hem, my tall letters, so everybody more or less saw me, you know, recognized and said hello, and especially sent all regards to you, Dick. And so, like I say, overall, it was a nice day, and we had, a lot of fun talking to a lot of people. Saw all kinds of stuff. Be amazed at what people find, what they think are unbelievable. Sometimes you see things that you just can't imagine. Anyhow, let's see, what else? Got this email. Oh, I got this email. Yes, I'm going to get the young fellow by the name of Tim. I'm going to get to him and his friend. They have a very serious problem here with mathematics. Formulas amateur, that apply to amateur radio. So before it gets too late, maybe we'll look into that, over.
Okay, you did have a breaker. Who was that person?
That was KE60AG, Bernie. I'm going to pass on the comment, get on with the young people's mathematical formulas. Those are a lot more important than my comment. I was just going to say I was out at Flushing Meadows and was disappointed you guys didn't have a big flashing neon sign. I would love to have met you. I'm just been monitoring the TechNet now for a third week in a row. I lived here about 10 years ago and used to love to listen to TechNet. I don't remember who was on, but it was always informative. So anyway, I'm going to call back to the woodwork here. I'm actually working on a little bit of food reports here, so I'll talk to you guys later. Kate, 60AV.
Okay, someday I'd like to find out what kind of physics work you do, Bernie. And, I've been here for 25 years, so I'm the major common denominator of the current series of TechNet, although they really did start way back in 1976 by one of the founders of this particular club. And and Mel has been coming more heavily involved over the last few years, and so TechNet is taking a little bit of load from me. I didn't get a chance to go to the House of Science, Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club, the flea market today because I was working. And it turns out for the last now 2 months, I work every Sunday. I supposedly retired in the year 2000, opened up a consulting business, and had some extremely interesting clients. And this latest client I've got is a fascinating guy who has a problem that is so interesting to me that I work almost all day Sundays with him. It involves antennas, high-power transmitters, receivers, but it's a project that we think has a lot of promise. I can't give you too many of the details. If we have half as much success as we think we're going to have, you will be hearing about this 6 months or a year from now, and we think it's going to have an impact on your lives. And that's what we believe. And this whole fall, of course, could be a bunch of hot air. But the project is so fascinating that I become a partner with my consulting clients, violating all the laws of what's recommended by the Long Island Consultants Network, the IEEE Consultants Network, of which I'm a member. I mean, they've got some very strong suggestions as to how you arrange business arrangements with your clients. And here I am entering in partnership, jumping in with both feet, because the guy has got a problem that is so fascinating, that's going to last for so long, but it's got such possible ramifications that I'm into it hook, line, and sinker, as you can tell. That's where I spend my Sundays, so it's very difficult for me to go to flea markets on Sundays anymore now. And I now work a little bit harder than when I used to work now that I'm retired. K2KEY, another supposedly retired guy, K2RIW.
Like the way you supposedly, that's right. You get yourself involved, tangled. And I try my best not to get too entangled anymore because, as I say, years are going by, and I would like to do a lot of things that I always dreamed of, and I know if I get too deeply involved, they'll be forgotten forever. All right, let's see. Let's get to Tim here. Reactive. Okay. Tim writes to me, and I had a couple of emails back and forth because I always like to try to get young people, especially on track, and I'm happy to see that they do have some interest in not only amateur radio, but also science and trying to learn, you know,